It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a political scientist will discuss the controversial ad that Governor Scott Walker's campaign released accusing challenger Mary Burke of sending jobs overseas.
But first, if your yard is overrun with weeds, invasive plants, or overgrown brush, a new low-tech solution is gaining popularity. Our next guest tries to provide a unique service by renting out goats and other livestock to eat away unwanted plant life.
Ben Roble is with us. He's the owner-operator of Vegetation Solutions in Muscadet. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where did you get the idea to rent out goats to help people get their weeds under control?
I knew they were doing a lot of this type of stuff out in California, and I knew that goats ate brush and weedy plants, so I had some property with overgrown trees and brush on it and got a few goats, and I saw what they were able to do and kept going from there.
And you started with a few goats. How many do you have now?
I'm up to 150 now.
Wow. Okay, so this is catching on.
Yes. Yep.
So my first maybe obvious question is, I presumably there are some plants I do want and some plants I don't want. How do the goats know?
They don't know. They're not selective. They won't avoid your garden and eat all the brush around it. We use electric netting for fencing, and so we fence them in areas you want the goats to eat all the vegetation, and we fence out the areas you don't want, like your garden or your yard or your flower bed or something like that.
So are people mostly doing this in, as you say, yards or on their flower beds, or where else are your goats showing up?
Anywhere. Not necessarily backyards, but like overgrown pastures that haven't been used. People's backyards that they're trying to reclaim, prairie restoration, trying to get rid of the brush that's encroaching in on prairies and grasslands.
And
but anybody with land is using our services.
Hmm. And do you use them? Do they eat some of the invasive species we have a problem with in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we do a lot of buckthorn removal, honeysuckle and sumac. Garlic mustard is another one in the springtime we do. The goats will pretty much eat everything we fence them into, so really there isn't anything they won't eat.
Did I see wild parsnip on a list? Aren't there things that like we react to and we really don't want to touch? The goats could still eat that stuff?
Yeah, wild parsnip is poisonous to us. Poison ivy is also, and the goats can eat it with no ill effects to them.
And now you've branched out from goats, I understand. What other livestock do you have?
We also have sheep. We use sheep also for controlling vegetation. The sheep are used in shorter vegetation situations. The taller vegetation is primarily used with goats. The goats can graze taller than the sheep can. So that's why we use different animals.
What are the advantages of using goats or sheep for plant control as opposed to weeding by hand, spraying, other options?
Well, when you're talking about 5 or 10 acres, it's kind of difficult to weed that or cut it all down by yourself. It's also expensive with a lot of man hours to do that. Chemical, people aren't really into spraying a bunch of chemical on their property, so it's an alternative to that. I'm sorry, I forgot where your question was.
Oh, yeah, so just you're getting to it there, the advantages of goats and sheep versus spraying. Yeah.
Yeah. Cost effectiveness, too. We can graze an area a lot cheaper than you can spray or cut an area.
And do you branch out into other goat lines? I mean, are you doing goat milk, too, with your herd?
No, our animals are used for vegetation control, and then excess animals are sold for meat.
Okay. So how far do you range with this? Do you get all the business you need in the local area, or are you headed all over the state?
We're headed all over the state. We cover the whole upper Midwest, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota.
And what kind of reactions do you get from people trying this for the first time? It was a new idea to me. I mean, I knew goats ate plants, but the idea of using them for targeted weed control. What do you hear from people when they do this for the first time?
Most people love it. They don't really have an understanding of how agriculture works and livestock and things like that. So a lot of people, I end up going to check on my animals, and I see lawn chairs next to the goat fencing because people are out there watching and observing the goat.
Hmm. How much supervision do you need? How many humans per goat or sheep to keep them on task?
I'm the only one who keeps track of them. The landowners that we go to will check on the goats once a day and give me an update, and then I will come to the site and move fences and do what needs to be done.
Now, I was just at our county fair this weekend, actually, in Dane County, and saw a lot of different breeds of goat, more than I knew existed. Is there a particular type of breed you're working with?
Yeah, primarily we use a meat goat breed called a Kiko goat, and they originated from New Zealand and were brought over to America a few years ago.
Are they particularly good for vegetation control, or were they just what was available?
Yeah, I like them for vegetation control. I've had a few other breeds. There's just attributes that I like about them more so than other goats. They're a pretty low-maintenance animal that can survive and thrive on the brush in situations that other animals might not be able to make it in.
And do you have to, is this like a monthly gig with someone or weekly, or how often do you have to go back to the same place with goats to keep things under control?
It all depends on the management practices of the landowner, but we definitely recommend 2 to 3 grazings per year on the same site, in the same area, to have effective vegetation control.
All right, Ben, thank you. Very interesting. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ben Roble. He's owner and operator of Vegetation Solutions in Muscadet. He uses goats to help keep weeds under control. One of Governor Scott Walker's re-election campaign ads has a lot of people talking in and out of Wisconsin. The 30-second ad accuses Democratic challenger Mary Burke of making her fortune at Trek Bicycle Corporation by sending jobs overseas. We'll take a listen.
Mary, Mary, quite contrary. How does your fortune grow? By making millions of dollars. Sending jobs overseas that could have been done in Wisconsin to countries where women and children might work up to 12 hours a day, earning only $2 an hour.
Only $2 an hour?
Interesting.
To be continued.
You mean there's more?
Yes, so much more.
And that is the ad that is sparking so much conversation in Wisconsin and beyond. Since its launch last week, the ad has gotten a lot of attention, including counter ads from Trek and from Mary Burke's campaign. Here to talk about this controversial ad and how it's playing out in the gubernatorial election so far is Charlie Jacobs. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So listening to that ad, what strikes you about it?
It's memorable, and those who hear it are going to remember it. It's almost like a little campaign earworm because of the way they use the nursery rhyme, which everyone knows. And so I think it's a very clever and creative ad that is going to spark a lot of conversation. The question, of course, that it raises is who's paying attention in the middle of July? I mean, it's an evocative ad, but is it something that's going to capture the attention of the people that Walker needs to make sure that he wins re-election?
Well, he's chosen to release it here in the middle of July. What does that tell you?
I think part of what the Walker campaign has been trying to do is define Burke before she can define herself. And so even if you look at one of the latest polls that has come out from Marquette, even at this late moment in the campaign, and I know we're still months away, but you know, this is a time for candidates to really be creating a foundation for themselves. You know, the Marquette poll indicates that somewhere more than 45% of the voters who were polled, the registered voters, indicated they didn't have enough information about Mary Burke to have either a favorable or unfavorable opinion. So what Walker can do here, if she's not in the game, if she's not defining her own biography, you know, the Walker campaign can jump in and start to set her biography and start to plant in voters' minds their perceptions of the opponent. And so I think in part that's what they're trying to do here, is to start a conversation about who is Mary Burke.
So he's trying to get out ahead of her own positioning there and shape that narrative. And what about politicians in Wisconsin? How are they reacting?
I mean, I think you've seen kind of some mixed reviews about the ad, and not just from the obvious candidates, you know, Democrats saying that it's a horrible advertisement full of lies. You've even seen some former Republicans and consultants talk about the problems with it. You've seen business people talk about attacking businesses in Wisconsin at a time that we should be trying to buoy them. So I think you've seen some mixed reaction. I think from the Walker camp and from Republicans who are supporting the governor, they think it's effective because it's trying to put some chinks in her armor related to her business experience, and that's what's going to be necessary to make sure that the public is more comfortable with Walker than with Burke.
And her business credits are a big part of her platform. Her success with Trek Bicycle, the success of that company in general. Is this something that is, you know, this ad, will that damage, do you think, credibility?
I'm not sure that it will, because to a certain extent, I think that the message might be a little bit obtuse, because I think that Trek has such a strong reputation in the state of Wisconsin as one of those real success stories, a success story that the Walker administration itself touted just a couple of years ago, that I think people might be a bit credulous about whether or not it's an accurate representation. So until I think there's something more substantive that really shows a direct connection between actions by Burke shipping, you know, substantial numbers of jobs out of the state in a way that really hurt the economy, I'm not sure it's going to be all that persuasive. And again, because it's coming at this time of the year, I'm not sure how many people are watching and taking these ads seriously at this moment. You know, most people who study this recognize the campaigns don't really kick off in a really meaningful way until after Labor Day, when people are back in their routines.
Well, Mary Burke's campaign and some Democrats, as you say Governor Walker should be ashamed for trashing a Wisconsin company like Trek Bicycle Corporation. What does that do to Governor Walker? Is there a chance that that could spin around and come back to bite him?
Hey, you know, as I said before, I think he's trying to define his opponent. But at the same time, I think he's opening up a whole bunch of doors that could provide, you know, really prove problematic for him. First is, if he raises this issue of lost jobs, I mean, there have been several reports about the Economic Development Corporation granting particular tax breaks to companies who then shipped jobs overseas. And of course, that's a program that he has touted. So I think that's a problem for him, because he held up Trek as this sort of bastion of good business practices in the state, one that was supposed to be used to attract more businesses here. I think it might be seen as sort of two-faced. On the one hand, he uses it when it's convenient, and he bashes when it's not. So, you know, if the Burke campaign can message well, I think that they can turn it on the governor. But again, she's kind of lagging in raising funds, and I'm not sure whether or not the Burke campaign wants to expend a lot of money trying to defend something that they think is kind of scurrilous.
One interesting thing about this ad is the amount of attention it's gotten, not just in Wisconsin, but also nationally. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal in the conservative opinion section, which compared Governor Walker's attack on Mary Burke's outsourcing to President Obama's attacks against Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential elections. And she goes on to say that Walker should focus on his own jobs record before he criticizes Burke's. She has some numbers at the end that support his jobs numbers, but some national attention there. Why is it creating ripples that go that far abroad?
Well, I'm wondering whether or not there are those who are in his camp for a run for presidency. And so they don't want him to undermine his own chances and want him to run a positive, forceful campaign that showcases all that he's done for the state, or all that at least he and his campaign claim that he's done for the state. And so focus on the positive. You want a recall election. In this kind of midterm year, you should be able to win a reelection to a governor's post. So I think that there might be some shadow of a presidential campaign that's sort of crowding this discussion. And the other issue here is whether or not that's going to fall on deaf ears with the governor, because they might be strategizing against putting any focus, or at least considerable focus, on their jobs record because of the promise he made in 2010 and the failure to meet that. Whether or not those are, you know, sort of credible arguments against what he's done in creating jobs in the state or not, I think that that's an issue for the governor, and whether or not he wants to focus on his own record in that regard.
Now, the ad comes at a time when Americans are still economically insecure. People aren't entirely back on their feet yet. The jobs numbers aren't where we would like them to be necessarily. Does that make this argument have a little more punch?
It probably does for voters who aren't following it sort of as deeply as people like I do and people like you do, who really sort of dig down and mine the data and mine the information. You know, they hear about the exportation of jobs to China or to another foreign country, and that's worrisome to them in an era when the growth has been so slow. But, you know, if people are paying some attention, then they've probably heard other of their elected officials, like Senator Ron Johnson, making arguments about whether or not it's really harmful to export certain jobs abroad, especially to China. Or even Paul Ryan talking about the same kinds of things a few years ago in the presidential campaign. So I think there's a bunch of mixed messages, and it might get a little bit muddled and confusing for the voter. And again, because of the reputation of this company, you know, it's a company that's making bikes in the United States, and there are hardly any companies who make a substantial number of bikes in the United States. I think that the public might give the benefit of the doubt to Trek in this one particular instance.
And as you said, the accusation here, one of outsourcing jobs, is one that is traditionally leveled from Democrats toward Republicans. Now here's Governor Walker sort of flipping that around. What does that say about his willingness to take risks in this campaign?
I mean, it is, and I think that was the intent of the Wall Street Journal piece, was to suggest that that's not the game Republicans should be playing, because, and I think the undercurrent of that argument is, you know, there is a time and a place that it's better to outsource jobs to create different types of and better jobs in the United States, and so it might be part of just sort of a broader message. That he's trying to develop to reach out to more groups and to paint himself as somebody who wants to think more critically about how the economy can develop in a state or in the nation. So I think that some of the numbers that he's seeing in some of the polls might be making him a little nervous, and he's really trying to reach out to as many voters as he can and try to corral those who might be sitting on the fence. Again, as you said, the uncertainty about the job market, the uncertainty about the economy, this might help flip enough votes to make sure he retains his place in Madison.
I want to ask you another thing about the ad itself, the tone of it. Is it unusual to you to see an ad like this? I guess it's been a while since the airwaves have been blanketed, but here you've got a mother in a cozy situation with her two children. There's this sort of... It's almost sort of sinister music in the background, sort of fairy tale, but sort of, you know, a little uneasy, too. I don't know. Does it catch people off guard because of that? Is there something especially compelling about it or disturbing because of the way that it comes across?
You know, this is a negative ad that almost feels a little positive because it's a little cutesy. And so I think that one of the really interesting and creative things about the ad is that I don't think it makes you feel as dirty when you finish watching it, that you've just seen this horrible negative campaign ad, even though that's what it is. Because you do have, you know, sort of the elder person reading the story to a younger person, and it makes you chuckle. Whether you're on the governor's side or not, it's a creative ad. But it is very negative, and the data show that negative ads work. I mean, they are much more compelling than positive ads. And so I think that the governor's campaign has done a very interesting and effective job of making a negative ad almost seem a little bit positive.
Hmm. Well, it's the ad that launched at least a few more ships, one of them here, the counter ad that Burke's campaign released. Let's listen.
Scott Walker's fairy tale ad, an outrageous attack on a great Wisconsin company. The real story? Mary Burke helped build Trek into a company where almost 1,000 Wisconsin people go to work every day, making more bikes in the U.S. than anyone. It's Walker's agency that gave millions in tax breaks to companies that relocated jobs overseas. Another reason Wisconsin's dead last in Midwest job growth. Scott Walker. Fairy tale ads. Fairy tale promises on jobs.
All right. What do you think about that for a rebuttal?
It's very strong. It relies on, you know, counterfacts. I mean, she wants to make sure that she gets her point across about what Trek is and try to define Trek. But again, I think one of the problems here is that she's responding instead of setting her own particular agenda and describing to the voters who she is before she has to react to somebody else's position and someone's critique of her as a candidate. So while I think the ad speaks very clearly to the accusations made by the governor's campaign, at the same time, it just seems like at this point in her campaign, she should be doing more about laying her own agenda in front of the public than trying to explain away facts laid out by her opponent. So it's a good ad. It's a strong ad, But again, at this point of the campaign, I think she should be doing probably more to develop her own biography for the public and not let the governor define her in this particular way.
We're talking right now to political scientist Charlie Jacobs about the controversial anti-Trek ad that Governor Scott Walker released as part of his reelection campaign.
And we're taking your calls coming up. What do you think about this ad, these ads? Was this a valid way to represent Mary Burke's career at Trek, or an unfair attack on a Wisconsin company? How do you think this ad will help or hurt Governor Walker's campaign, Mary Burke's campaign hopes as well? And have you seen these ads while you've been watching the TV?
We're picking up our conversation with political scientist Charlie Jacobs about the controversial ad Governor Scott Walker's campaign released, accusing Democratic challenger Mary Burke of sending jobs overseas during her time at Trek Bicycle.
And we want to hear what you think about this kerfluffle. Was this a proper way to represent Mary Burke's career at Trek, or an unfair attack on a Wisconsin company? Do you think this ad will help or hurt the governor or his challenger? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And we're going to go to the phones right now and take Chris from Lake Mills. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My wife and I first saw this ad a couple of nights ago, and our first impression was that this was such a negative, horrible ad that our thoughts were, how could a mother sit with her two young children and drag them through this political nightmare that we've got, that we're presented with, and then presented in a cutesy format like, oh, this is really no big deal. It was just such a negative, horrible ad. It just reinforced the fact that we don't like Scott Walker, we don't like what he represents, and we won't be voting for him.
All right, Chris, thank you. So it really touched a nerve there with Chris, Charlie. This is an ad which you thought was a little bit cozy and made you chuckle a little bit, not so much with Chris. What do you think about his reaction?
Well, Chris is obviously not a fan of Scott Walker, and so you would imagine that would be the kind of reaction. But remember, Scott Walker is going after the people who haven't made up their mind. Scott Walker's lost Chris. Apparently, he's also lost Chris's wife, and that's their opinion and that's their vote. But the ads aren't really aimed at those people. There's a small group of people that both Burke and Walker are fighting over. And so, again, my argument about the ad being somewhat cutesy is that it's not a traditional negative ad in the sense of, sort of dark, grainy pictures and these sort of large words put up on a screen. It's something that really sort of makes you stop and look and listen in a much more, I think, critical way than a lot of these other ads, where you automatically tune them out because you know what's coming. And so while I don't necessarily disagree with the argument that Chris is making, I think what the Walker campaign is doing is targeting this at a particular group of individuals. And in that way, they've tried to frame a negative ad in a way that's a little bit more palatable to most people.
Do you have a sense of how many of those narrow margin of undecideds are here in Wisconsin?
I'm not sure I understand your question. How many of the undecideds about?
Yeah, you said he's aiming at and Mary Burke both are aiming their ads at a very slim portion of people who haven't made up their mind yet. Do we know how many people haven't made up their minds?
If and again, I don't have the poll right in front of me, but I think that the undecideds are running somewhere around 4 to 6%. And so, you know, Walker and Burke are really hoping that these people who haven't yet made up their mind find something in the news, something in an ad, something that they hear or read about the candidates will make concrete their decisions sooner rather than later. And so it's these kind of ads. How many can you pick off? How many can you turn against Mary Burke? And that's my argument about setting the biography, about trying to get in the minds of the people who you are and whether or not you can be trusted and whether or not the positions you're taking are valid. And so the one danger, and I think this speaks to Chris directly, is the danger in this kind of ad. If it creates that kind of reaction in someone like Chris, and I'll just use him as an example because he called, if he was going to sit this one out for some reason, well, now he's not because he is so angered by the ad and he's so animated. So if you rile up your opponent's base, you can do yourself a lot of harm. But since in Wisconsin we have a tradition of high voter turnout, I'm not sure whether or not the campaign for Walker is all that concerned. Those who don't like him and will vote against him are going to the polls anyway, whether this ad is vitriolic or not.
Well, we thank you for your call, Chris, and we're going to move next to Alan in Appleton. Hi, Alan.
Hi. A couple things. The one you already touched on was the to me it seems like, I don't know if Walker's lost his identity, that he thinks he's a Democrat with what he's trying to pull with this ad, because the one thing of shipping jobs overseas, you spoke of Johnson before, they obviously don't have a problem with that, so you're not going to get a Republican upset about that. The other thing is the $2 an hour thing, which what Republican knocks somebody else for paying less money? I mean, no Republican has ever endorsed or honest Republican has ever endorsed a minimum wage increase that they really believed in. So I think he's got an issue with this campaign that I understand what you're saying, that he's trying to get, you know, the independent voter. But the independent voter is going to see, you know, that this doesn't make sense, what he's trying to say. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that call, Alan. And it sounded as though earlier, Charlie, you were saying that Scott Walker had gotten out ahead of Mary Burke and was starting to define the message of who she was and her business record, and she was playing catch-up a bit. But does this also, as maybe Alan was getting it there, highlight some of the problems he might have creating chinks in the armor of a business that has got a good reputation in Wisconsin?
Well, and not only that, but for Democrats, she's a good candidate because she has this business experience and this business acumen, which most would associate with Republicans who come out of big business, and they would make the argument that they'd run government like a business, and since they know how to run a business, they'll run government efficiently. And so Mary Burke has that sort of trump card against the governor. And, you know, I would agree with Alan that some of these things sort of make the governor look a little schizophrenic because he's sort of taking both Democratic and Republican sides. So I was just talking about animating your opponent's base. Well, another technique you can try to use is suppress your opponent's base. And so if you've got liberals or Democrats who might have questions about their own candidate, if you can convince them that their candidate isn't liberal enough or democratic enough for them, it might give them reason to just stay home. And those are lost votes for Burke. Hmm. So, you know, if you want to say Chinese workers make $2 an hour, and yet she's calling for an increase in the minimum wage in this state and around the country, what are we to believe? Is she really for the worker if she's willing to ship jobs that are very low-paying to China? Boy, that's not my candidate. I can't vote for Walker, but I can't vote for Burke, so I'm staying home.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your call, Alan. And next we go to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hey, Joe.
Hi. I'm curious. When Mary was working for Trek, who was governor, and what was the political and economic climate at the time, and what caused Trek to move? And is Mary offering any solutions to change that where they might stay?
Okay, thanks, Joe. Charlie?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact timeline for when all of these events occurred, because it's still a little unclear. Was she working for the company when the decision was made to outsource the jobs? What kind of impact did she have on that kind of decision? What kind of effect did it have on her? So I think that these are questions that have not yet been adequately answered by Trek and Mary Burke and Mary Burke's brother as well. So, I think that... Again, this is where we start to get into the devil that are the details, and whether or not both the public is willing to learn them, listen to them, and whether or not either campaign wants them to come out, because they might be beneficial to one side or the other. I don't have an answer to that, and I don't really think we've heard adequate answers yet to those kinds of questions.
Now, this is one of the very first shots and skirmishes here in the form of ads going on here in Wisconsin in the governor's race. Does this signal to you that this is where a major battleground will be fought over the business record of Mary Burke? Or is this just one of many?
Well, I think it depends on how the Walker campaign is going to handle the economy and jobs issues, which will dog the campaign because of his campaign promise in 2010. And so whether or not this is a way to inoculate themselves against any criticism, that he didn't create 250,000 jobs, that we're lagging in the Midwest in job creation, we're lagging nationally in job creation, this might be just that kind of way to make the voter focus on the other candidate and not his shortcomings or perceived shortcomings that might be illuminated by the press and the Democrats. So I'm not sure whether or not this is an attack on her business acumen or just a way to sort of sweep under the rug some of his own issues that have arisen during his time in office.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College.
Time now for Wisconsin Life. Writer Michael Perry has been thinking about the places he loves most. One of them is a kitchen, and not just any kitchen. This one changed his life.
Early in our courtship, my wife, Annalisa, took me to visit Tom and Arlene, an elderly farm couple she'd grown close to during her teenage years. We stepped through the screen door and seated ourselves in the kitchen. The kitchen is small and close, dominated by the bulwark of a cast-iron wood range dating to 1893. Add to that the encroaching cupboards, the kitchen sink and dish-stacked countertops, a refrigerator, a modern electrical stove, and an overloaded coat rack, and there's not a lot of room to maneuver. The wooden floors are dark brown and unpolished, but worn to smoothness by over a century of boot soles. The table, as I have come to know over the course of many subsequent visits, is always happily cluttered with mail and pens and notepads and cookies and saltines and, always, a Skippy jar filled with peanut M&Ms. The worn floor, the dim corners, the bacon grease undertones, this is the same kitchen I've known from clear back to my grasshopper-sized days in Sampson Township. These are not the kitchens of slick magazines and stainless steel appliances. These are the kitchens of clutter and stack, of the dish rag hung and the pans piled, of the countertop bucket spilling onion husks and potato peels. Company is happily received with no preemptive clearing of the decks, just clomp right in, boots and all. Your chair is waiting, more often than not left at an open angle, ready to receive the next visitor. What I'm saying is, the first time I walked through Tom and Arlene's door with Annalisa and stepped into that kitchen, even though I had never been there before, I knew exactly where I was. When Annalisa and I left that night, and after I had dropped her off and was headed back to my very bachelor home, there had been a key change within me. As I watched her laugh and trade stories, I saw signs of an old soul, a person who paid her respects and paid them to the sort of people much of the world passes by at top speed. Prior to our night in Tom and Arlene's kitchen, I saw Annalisa as beautiful, desirable, smart, and strong. More than enough, in other words, and easily more than I had earned. But as I watched how she honored Tom and Arlene with nothing fancier than honest talk and clear laughter, I began to realize I had found a person perfectly and unpretentiously matched to the roughneck kitchen of my dreams.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life at WPT Monday nights at 8 p.m. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Next, as Milwaukee grapples with its persistent gun violence problem, the issue is far from unusual in cities around the country. In Baltimore, owning a gun is a necessity, according to our next guest, who says he grew up feeling like he needed a gun.
Today, Dee Watkins is an established journalist and an adjunct professor at Coppin State University. He runs a creative writing workshop at the Baltimore Free School. His piece, Gunplay is All I Know, just ran in Salon. Dee, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
I'm great, great. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that it's easier to get a gun than a job in East Baltimore. How easy was it to get a gun when you were growing up?
Well, as a child growing up in East Baltimore, there was numerous locations around my own neighborhood where you could get a gun from. And I'm not talking about traditional gun stores. I'm talking about houses where people had boxes and boxes and boxes of guns. Whatever you want, automatic, revolvers, extended clips, assault rifles. You can pretty much get whatever you wanted.
And you even took a gun to prom. How come? Why was that necessary?
At that particular time, in the early 2000s, people were being murdered. And, you know, I never shot anyone. I never would want to see anything bad happen to anyone, but I also didn't want to see anything bad happen to me or my date. So that was something that I had to do.
Now, just recently, you were floored by the death of your friend Free, who got hit and killed by mistake in a gun accident during some gun violence. But he's far from the first death by gun that you've actually been through in your life. What happened with Free?
He was a great guy. He was a city worker. He's never been like, he had some small brushes with the law that I found out about recently, but never anything serious. Just like Open Container or Lord of the Rings or things like that. But, you know, he got his life together. He used to always tell everyone in our neighborhood that we need to be organ donors. And he was a great guy. He worked for the city. He was taking care of his two daughters. He was a great guy. And he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some guys got in an argument. They started shooting, and a bullet hit the wall, bounced off of the wall and hit him. So, you know, it wasn't even meant for him. And it was just a super unfortunate situation because for me, you know, being in my early 30s, you know, I'm used to, like, when I was a kid, I was always used to people who were like 16, 17 years old getting murdered, and guys who were like 40, it didn't really happen like that, especially guys who weren't in the street. And he wasn't a street guy, so, you know, it was in a situation there. You know, I feel bad for him and his family.
So you said, you know, he was a family guy, he had daughters, and he wasn't a street guy. But how common was it for people you knew to be shot and killed in the part of Baltimore where you live?
Well, it happens a lot. You know, I go, at a minimum, I go to at least about 2 funerals a year.
Wow.
It's not that it's uncommon, but a lot of times, you know, these are guys who are more reckless in participating in illegal activities, who are, you know, my family members or my friends or the kids of my friends and things like that. But for a guy like Free, it was just so strange to me because, you know, again, you know, you think a guy who works for the city that's in his 40s wouldn't die like that, you know, so.
You know, you write in your piece, you say, I know cops hated me when I was a notorious dope dealer, and now they hate me as a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen who pulls kids off the corner. I can't remember a time when I wasn't being harassed or profiled. What do you think has gone wrong with the way police deal with gun violence as you see it?
I think there's a big error in communication. I think that a lot of cops, you know, they see a person like me, and I don't know if you know what I look like or not, but that's me on the article.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which I guess doesn't really say a lot, but they see a person like myself, and, you know, they see some of the people who, you know, some of the places we go, and, you know, some of the places we hang, and some of my family members and things like that, and they tend to put us all in the same box. Whereas if you see me and my friends, you might see a guy who just came home from prison who's trying to get his life together. You might see me, who's a college professor, and you might see another friend of mine who's develops websites. But just because we're all from a certain section of East Baltimore, they put us in a box, and they treat us all like criminals without even getting a chance to understand, you know, who they're talking to. Because, you know, we are potentially we have the same agenda. Cops don't want to see guys selling drugs in the streets, and I don't want to see guys selling drugs in the streets, but they look at us, and they see our style of dress, and they see, you know, the way we wear our haircuts and things like that, and they just put us all in the box, and it's kind of not fair. And I think that if the Baltimore Police Department took more time to, you know who are the people in their neighborhoods and what they do and what they're about, I think these things wouldn't happen. Because, like I said, cops pulled a gun on me, and I was just putting a scooter in my garage.
Well, today you're a successful writer. You've got a big presence online. You're a professor. Do you still feel like you have that? Like you have need for a gun? Do you still need one?
Yeah, I do. I do need a gun. And, you know, again, I'm not into guns. I'm not that guy who's going to go to the gun range. One of the guns I own right now has never been shot, ever. And I had it for, you know, for a long time, maybe like 10 years. So it's like, I need it because, you know, in Baltimore, people will come in your house. They will try to attack you and your family. People will, you know, they'll try you. And, you know, a lot of people are trying to harm you, even, you know, some of the police officers. So it's like, it's more or less a protection thing. I would love to live in a world where I didn't need it, but there's so many evil people out there that make you need it to feel safe. And I hate that. I hate that feeling. But you know, I don't want to die in my own house. And no, I don't carry it or take it out of my house. So it's mainly like, you know, a home thing.
Well, Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, is in the grips of a gun violence problem now. Do you have any advice for city leaders about how to stop it?
I think communication is the key. I think, you know, gun buyback programs seem to do, you know, pretty well as far as like giving a lot of guns off the street. But I think if, you know, police officers were able to communicate more with the people in some of these communities, then you would see like a drastic change. And then I also think that even from the street level, like it's always a communication error. It's always like some male bravado thing, who's the toughest, who's the last man standing. And even a lot of those issues could be solved through basic, simple communication. Legal or illegal, we all want the same things. You know, we all want to see our families do well. We all want to experience love. We all want to be successful. We're all human. So, you know, a lot of these guys these gun slinging guys are just the products of American culture in general. I can't communicate with you, so I must kill you.
Hmm. Well, one thing that you say in your piece, you write that murder culture seems to be as permanent in African American culture as hip hop. Does it have to be that way? Are there solutions here that we're missing? Is it the communication that you're just talking about?
It's the communication. You know, most of these people, you know, as a small child, you know, gun culture so here in Baltimore. One of the first murders I ever saw was a guy killed another guy over $1, you know? Hmm. And it ties back into that culture of, you know, you're not going to disrespect me, you're not going to take advantage of me. You're not going to be the kind of person that can do anything to make me look, you know, soft or inadequate or, you know, just not like a stand-up guy. So all of these things are tremendous communication errors that lead to people not believing in humanity, that lead to people doing these monstrous acts.
Dee, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Hopefully everything works out down there. I hate, you know, I don't even like having these conversations. I just want people to spread love.
We appreciate you being on and talking. Dee Watkins is a writer and an adjunct professor at Coppin State University. He runs a creative writing workshop at the Baltimore Free School. His piece, Gunplay is All I Know, just ran in Salon.com.